Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author Tom Piazza discusses his novel, The Auburn Conference, with book list editor Donna Seaman. The following conversation originally took place September 10th, 2023, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Thanks for coming out on this beautiful afternoon. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director here at the AWM. We're here today to imagine a moment in literary history. In the Auburn Conference, Tom Piazza posits a discussion of the future of the United States with Mark Twain, Frederick Douglass, Herman Melville, Walt Whitman, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Confederate memoirist Forrest Taylor, and romance novelist Lucy Comstock, all talking on race, class, gender, and the American ideal. Tom Piazza's books include City of Refuge, the short story collection Blues and Trouble, the post-Katrina manifesto Why New Orleans Matters, and the essay collection Devil Sent the Rain, Music and Writing in Desperate America. He was a principal writer for the innovative New Orleans-based HBO drama series Tremé, and the winner of a Grammy Award for his album Notes to Martin Scorsese Presents the Blues, A Musical Journey. He's here visiting from New Orleans. He's here to discuss the Auburn Conference with Donna Seaman, the editor of adult books for Booklist. Please join me in welcoming them both.
Thank you, Allison. So I'm thrilled to be here with Tom Piazza, whose work I admire so much. Let's begin with, did you want to read the opening passage? We had talked about that.
I could do that.
Yeah, sure. Just to give you a little taste of this novel, which is both extremely funny and very moving.
Let me say something really quickly also before I do that. It's great to see everybody. I just want to say, I'm so happy to be here with Donna Seaman, who is just like, there should be a plaque to her someplace. She's a national resource, and the energy and presence that she brings to book reviewing and to all her other activities, really something else. So when I found out we were going to be able to do this, I was just knocked out.
Oh, thank you.
So Donna had asked me to read from the beginning, the opening of the book, which I guess is fair enough. I'll skip around just a bit just to give you an idea of just what the point is of the book. So, well, you'll find out who it is speaking as I read it. I have come to the conclusion that the entire nation is insane. Still, it is with a mixture of satisfaction, frustration, and hope that I, Frederick Olmsted Matthews, assemble for posterity this record of the events of June 1883 at the first annual Auburn Writers Conference, known to all now simply as the Auburn Conference. Sadly, of course, it was also the last annual Auburn Conference, for reasons that will no doubt be evident by the conclusion of this account. If I were to have the opportunity to organize another such gathering, but I will abort this thought as there is no such likelihood, and I have become convinced through many a season that we never do truly learn from our mistakes. And I should say that he talks a little bit about who he is and what he's doing. He's a rather underappreciated junior lecturer at a little tiny college in upstate New York. And his whole thing is American literature. He stays up late reading Melville and Whitman and Ralph Waldo Emerson. And he idolizes these people. And he was kind of came of age after the close of the Civil War. And he has this very idealistic notion of the possibilities of the country. But unfortunately, the members of his faculty don't really agree, and he's sort of marginalized in a lot of ways that he hates. And I'll read you just a little bit that follows along with that line of thought. So he says, as my second year of teaching at the Institute drew to a close, a cloud overtook me. Where was the bold conversation that I had hoped to find upon my emergence into the world? What was I doing with my talents, such as they were? And underneath those questions lurked something else, a nagging feeling of dread having to do with America itself. One had read spiritual and moral purpose in the books written in the years leading up to the Civil War. Every chapter, every line was charged with meaning. The fate of the nation, of democracy itself, seemed to hang in the balance. Yet now, with the war, not 20 years in the past, that sense of spiritual and moral urgency had dissipated. The accumulation of wealth had become the sole apparent purpose of every citizen. Railroads crossed the land, bridges spanned the rivers, factories and mills proliferated and generated unimagined profits, even as financial panics, labor riots, governmental corruption, and profiteering ran rampant. The southern states, with the North conveniently distracted by other matters, had returned their colored population to a condition near slavery in all but name. What were we doing with the freedom that had been won at such a cost? Was it no more than a license to enrich ourselves at others' expense? The nation did not know what to do with its freedom. And so out of that set of sentiments, eventually by a couple turns of the plot, resulted in this conference that he plans.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. So an idealistic gathering. And he, so I have two questions. One, tell us why you set this novel in Auburn, New York, a tiny little place.
Mm-hmm. Some years back, I was teaching at a college up in upstate New York, not far from Auburn, Hobart William Smith College. I had a sort of year-long residency there. And while I was there, my much better half, Mary, came up to visit. And Mary will always find the interesting museum, no matter where we are. I'll be happy to go to record stores and bookstores, you know. Mary will find something really interesting, and she found out that there was a museum in William Seward's house. And William Seward was a senator at that time, very active in the Underground Railroad, and he was eventually Secretary of State under Abraham Lincoln. So we visited Seward's house, and it was a fascinating place for a lot of reasons to visit. And it, in fact, gave me the idea of using it in the novel that I was about to start writing at that time, A Free State, my previous novel. And that's set in 1855. So when this sort of bunch, what an unfortunate word, this grouping of ideas kind of began to suggest itself to me, I thought that Auburn would be a good place to hold it.
And a certain, so we have, going to name the amazing writers. And I have to say, when I was reading this book, I love the American Writers Museum. I've been involved with it since before it existed. And I thought to myself, this is a perfect novel to talk about here in the Writers Museum, because all these seminal writers, Walt Whitman, Frederick Douglass, Herman Melville, Mark Twain, Harriet Beecher Stowe, are on the wall when you walk in here. This is a place dedicated to thinking about the role of American writers in creating a nation built on ideas and writing and, you know, documents and concepts and dreams that we have yet to live up to. So I was thrilled when this worked out and Tom could actually be here. So this young guy, Matthews, who's, you know, he's such a dedicated teacher, and you really relate to him. And he has the unbelievable luck of getting these people to show up to this little town. But what interested me about Auburn was I did not know that Harriet Tubman lived there. And there's a really interesting backstory about the house she lived in and how it burned down and they built her another house. She built a bunch of houses for family. And I mean, she's like a remarkable person. And she is a friend, of course, of Frederick Douglass. So there's all kinds of funny parallels we were talking about earlier in relationships among these writers. And Tom writes from different points of view. And I want to ask you about that. I mean, it's one thing to create Matthews and write from his perspective. He's yours. He's your guy. But Herman Melville, I mean, we're in his head. So I think you were able to bring all these famous writers to life through a lifetime of reading, I imagine, research. I don't know. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, some of the writers more than others, but most of them really I've been living with for, you know, my entire reading life, my whole adult, semi-adult life. And also I should say, you know, I guess you're sort of asking me how I wrote it.
Yeah, how'd you have the nerve to write as though you're Herman Melville?
Well, in a funny, it really comes out of voice, you know. So of course I had been reading sort of the canonical works of these different writers, along with Ralph Waldo Emerson and a lot of, you know, Lincoln's writings, all of that. But the sound of their utterance, not just in their published writing, in their canonical works, if you will, but in their letters, in the record of their public speaking, journals in a lot of cases, the sound is what led me. And I should say I'm a musician too. I play jazz piano, I play guitar. And probably that's connected up with the fact that sound has always been even more than the visuals, although I do as well as I can with that. But the voices of those characters came to me from reading and knowing about, just, I would say, almost approaching them from inside.
Yes.
You know, in other words, you can read from outside what a writer is writing for, the putative content of what they're saying. You know, the message or the information, but the style of their relation to what they're saying. This may sound kind of abstract, but in other words, if I tell you, I just love French fries, okay, well, you know that I would say that I love French fries. But if I go, yeah, I love French fries, there's obviously an angle between the actual words and what I think, which is like I'm saying I don't love French fries. So that kind of relationship between a speaker and the information that they're supposedly imparting is, that's the angle that tells you something about their character. Can I say one other thing about that?
Yes,
And I'm sorry, this was all very non-specific to writers, and I could talk about the specific writers. I'll start with, I can just say one thing about, with Walt Whitman, who was a challenging person to deal with because he has such a oceanic kind of presence in our literary, you know, imagination. And I thought, how am I going to get him to talk? Because he was such, he made such a direct address to the reader, you know, as, and what I think you shall think, and what I, you know, and I am Kentucky, I am California. And I just thought, how would he sound when he was just talking? And, you know, of all the writers who are included in this narrative, there's only one, and it was Whitman, that there was a sound recording of.
Yes, right.
And it's fragmentary. It's less than, I think, less than 40 seconds. And it, most of it sounds, you know how they used to have the old 78s and cylinders used to sound like, that background, you know? And the most of it sounds like Whitman is saying, you know, you're just kind of going, well, this is a lot of use. But then at one point, the one word kind of always pops out to me. I go, ample. And I thought, ample. You know, he sounded like a Brooklyn taxi cab driver. And of course, Whitman lived a lot of his life in Brooklyn and came up on Long, he was born on Long Island, as I was. And so I thought, of course, he has this tremendously inflated, sounds kind of derogatory, but let's say inflated rhetoric that he's able to access in his poetry. But really at his heart, he was kind of a guy who hung out in bars in Greenwich Village. And, you know, that's a fascinatingly complex character. That was a key for me. And
perfect. I've heard that clip. And yes, I mean, he's, passages with him are hilarious. I mean, you have him, he's sort of writing a poem while he's there about the conference. And, and, you know, you really pull that off with that. It's not parody. I mean, it's like a perfect sort of embodiment of Whitman, but it's also very funny. And he's in such contrast to how you portray Herman Melville, who's very depressed and, you know, sort of, so they offer these kind of different, you know, there's Whitman's hope, everything's beautiful and we're open and we're going to grow and everything's ample. It's a perfect word that's what you can hear. And Melville's kind of like, I don't know, this is, you know, people are pretty complicated and contradictory and, you know, irrational. And, so, and that dichotomy kind of constantly plays out, and it plays out within Matthews also. He's back and forth with this. I want to ask you about two of the other writers that appear in this conference who are fictional. And poor Matthews kind of gets forced to accept them because his, you know, his job's on the line, basically. One is this Forrest Taylor, a Confederate general on stage with Frederick Douglass, okay. And then Lucy Comstock, a romance writer who I loved. She's hilarious. So where did these invented writers come from, and why did you need them?
Well, Why did I need them is an interesting question. You know, I didn't have a brief for them in advance. They sort of arrived and insisted on being included. And there, so for this Confederate general, Forrest Taylor, has written a memoir, initially what happened was the provost of the school, in sort of making a deal with this young professor to organize, who wants to organize this conference, he says, well, could you include Joel Chandler Harris? And Joel Chandler Harris was the writer who wrote the Uncle Remus stories, those very highly stylized, to us, to our ears now, very pretty offensive, but based on folk tales of going back to Aesop and before, of course. Anyway, can you include him? Because my children love them, love those stories. So the organizer, Matthews, gets in touch with Joel Chandler Harris, and he doesn't want to make the trip up from Georgia, but he recommends his friend Forrest Taylor, this Confederate memorized, and so he comes. So he is based actually on a writer and a former Confederate general named Richard Taylor, who's the son of former President Zachary Taylor, who's his quasi-hero, I guess, of the Mexican War. And Richard Taylor wrote a memoir called Destruction and Reconstruction, which is a kind of grisly memoir of Southern grievance after the Civil War. And so it's written in this highly patrician, kind of condescending style. So he sounds very elegant, and he's always making reference to classical, Greece and Rome and blah, blah, blah. But underneath, there's this seething anger and resentment. There's a fascinating character is embodied in that text. So I thought, well, he should be there because he's coming up. He's a kind of, since Frederick Douglass is going to be there, these are two powerful vectors of a completely different take on the same set of givens. Now, as far as Lucy Comstock, the romance writer, man, where did she come from? Well, in the book, where she comes from is the
another relative. So
the head of the English department, who is kind of the nemesis of our guy Frederick Matthews. The head of the English department was always telling him, stop talking about philosophy, no religion, don't give me politics, I don't want to hear any of this, just confine yourself to literature. And Frederick Matthews goes, confine yourself to literature? It's like saying, confine yourself to the sky or the open, and he's furious at being, so he's constantly being kind of tamped down by this department chair. But when the time comes that this literary festival is going to happen, it turns out the department chair's wife is a big fan of this romance novel writer, Lucy Comstock. And the department chair has to go almost on his knees to Frederick Matthews to say, my wife isn't speaking to me because Lucy Comstock's not invited. And if there's any possible way. So Matthews kind of goes, geez, a romance novel writer. Well, but okay, if that's my ticket to have him on my side, we'll do it. So that's how she came in. And she's a great character because she's as smart as anybody on the panel and utterly practical. She makes plenty of money. She's, the stuff of her books is, rippling pectorals and, take me, and eventually, ending up in a marriage, which is, of course, what everybody desires, above all else. But in her life, she's all alone. She doesn't need anybody. She doesn't care about men. She loves men, but, it's like, next, she's a sort of a proto-feminist, in a lot of ways. She's financially independent. She calls all the shots. So anyway, she was a lot of fun.
She's
glad
great.
She showed up.
Well, and you have, she's up there, she promotes herself every sentence.
My books are for
sale in the lobby. But also she's like, women's lives count, women's lives matter, women need escape, they do all the work, you can't run a household or a country without women. So she's really great. And I guess I just want to have an idea of the cast, because they're so essential. All the personalities they're the catalyst for all the action. So there's also an ambitious and very cynical newspaper reporter who immediately sows seeds of trouble in this
Yeah, it was funny. The first chapter is all in the voice of this idealistic young writer who organizes the conference, but I don't know what happened, but the second chapter began being in the voice of this local newspaper reporter who's arrogant and very smart and also seething,
seething.
with resentment at being stuck in what he regards as this backwater of Auburn, New York. And he thinks he's bound for better things. I should be in New York, at the New York World, and he's just dying to get out. And so he's looking at these posters for this conference, this junior lecturer has set up, and he's like, who the heck is going to go to this stuff? You know, you're going to get like a handful of people, and let's stir the pot a little bit. So he goes around to some different places and says, you know, I don't want to get too involved in detail, but it might be interesting to know there was a town in upstate New York called Town Line, which was the only municipality in the Northeast to actually secede from the Union during the Civil War. So the place was still riven with these kind of seething, you know, resentments and angers, and, you know, and so he goes there and he tells the guy who runs the bank, you know, Frederick Douglass is going to be on this panel with Forrest Taylor. And the president of the bank goes, we'll have a delegation there to meet that Douglass, you know. And then he goes to some people who are, you know, Northern sympathizers and says, you know, they're going to be putting this Confederate general up against our hero, Frederick Douglass. And they're like, we'll have a delegation there to meet those, you know. So anyway, so he's always stirring the pot and trying to get something going because he wants to be able to write a feature about it that can be his sort of calling card to move on to a big newspaper in New York. And if that sounds like this, I mean, I guess as I was writing him, I realized that it was, you know, and I, in some ways, the mass media have a vested interest in conflict. And as the reporter even says to himself at one point, he says, no reporter ever made a name for himself writing a story's headline, Calm Sea off Nantucket. You know, so,
yeah.
You
know. Well, it's great because he gives us another perspective on the whole idea of writing and storytelling. Yeah. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's going to change the news. He wants to make news. He's not just going to report.
Exactly.
So of course, I mean, one of the great appeals of historical fiction, I believe, is how it reflects our lives. And, you know, as you're reading this, I mean, the very opening sentence feels like now, and a lot of the seething that we're seeing is rooted back in the time in which this novel is set. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about when you were working on this, if you were kind of looking at present day issues and divisions. And, you know, there's a lot of talk among these writers about people that are denying facts about recent history then, but still that sort of state of denial continues. Mark Twain talks about amnesia. So these are, you know, we're in a time where people are trying to censor history itself. Banning books, revising our perspective on slavery, mm-hmm. As though there could be multiple mm-hmm. perspectives. So was that part of what was going on in this novel for you, sort of looking at the present and seeing echoes of the past?
Yeah, absolutely. I have trouble staying interested in his quote-unquote historical fiction that doesn't have one foot on each of those logs in some kind of way, you know? I mean, there's a purpose to historical fiction that can be sort of like a getaway, you know, let's go spend a couple of weeks in the court of Henry VIII, you know, or, oh boy, I just went rough riding with Teddy Roosevelt and his guys, what a bunch of knuckleheads, you know, whatever. But I tend to be more interested in historical fiction where the themes and the sort of spring in the watch is kind of exportable into our comprehension of contemporary life. It wasn't that hard with this book. No. I mean, I began writing this book in 2018. So that was, in fact, right on the eve of the midterm elections. I don't know if any of you here are old enough to remember 2018, but
it does seem like a long time ago.
you know, it was the midpoint of the previous presidency. And then, as now, there were a lot of reasons to ask oneself, what the heck were we doing with our freedom? How were we spending it? And what were we spending it on? And why? And the thing that's remarkable to me is that we're wrestling over the same set of questions that we were, and it's 140 years since the Auburn Conference. It was the same questions, you know, with women's rights. Should women have even any kind of agency over their own bodies? There's a group of suffragists who show up here who come in fairly late in the novel going, why is this issue not being discussed? And they cause a ruckus, a righteous ruckus. And we're asked, you know, what about, let's say the fact that there are really nefarious efforts being made to dismantle a lot of the voting rights that people have died fighting for over the decades. So these are questions that are being wrestled over in the conference. They're still being wrestled over. And in a sense, you could read through the text of this book and find resonance to just about everything that's happening in our lives today. That would be my conceit anyhow,
I think. Yeah, absolutely true. Very true. And that whole idea of, you know, truth and truthiness, as Compare puts it, you know, and so we have this reporter who's, you know, just stirring things up for the sake of a byline. And then someone, you know, Forrest Taylor just rewriting the, you know, what completely off. And the difficulty of listening to each other. I mean, that's just clashing. And we see that now so amplified with, you know, technology's really made all that much more dramatic. So, you know, this is kind of a crucible, but it's in person and, you know, it's in books. Now, you know, it's so vast and even more difficult to
Also, one of the things I was trying to do in the book as well, because it's not just a series of debates among these different personae. They all have this public, let's say this life as citizens, public citizens, each of them. Any writer does, after all, as soon as they publish something, if not before. So they all have this life as public figures, but then they all have a very significant interior life as well, that's often at a degree of an angle to their lives as public figures. You know, I mean, it's kind of a commonplace. You say a lot of artists have insecurities. So you see them as, my God, this is the great whoever, you know, and then inside they're going, God, did they like me? You know, so not that there's anything that straightforward or obvious in here, but each of these writers exists at both as these public figures and at an angle to their lives as public figures, and they interact with each other on both levels throughout the book. There's a late night scene. Did you enjoy the storytelling contest?
I love that scene. Yes, that's why I wanted to bring up Harriet Tubman so we could talk about that.
Okay,
scene.
Well, we'll do.
And this is a crux of the book that makes it so interesting, that you get inside them. So they're, you know, especially like Mark Twain, you know, he knows he has to perform. It's not even his real name. So it's this whole thing. And you really, you know, he's just wicked. And Harriet Beecher Stowe really resists that. You know, she doesn't want to play that. So then we have a storytelling contest kind of.
Well, I brought it up, but the story, you know, celebrity, that's maybe a slightly skewed term to use, but it is, whatever we mean by celebrity is a kind of running theme through the book too, in a funny kind of way. And Frederick Douglass and Mark Twain are both at this point in their lives, at this point in history, in effect, celebrities, certainly people who are celebrated and people who do a lot of public, you know, public experience, public speaking, public whatever, they're public figures. And so they find a little time to get away themselves in this little house that's being used as a kind of dorm for the visiting writers. And they stay up late and they just want to get together and be peers, you know. So Mark Twain and Frederick Douglass decide to have a storytelling contest over brandy and cigars. And Frederick Douglass comes and he brings Harriet Tubman with him. And he's staying at Harriet Tubman's house, which William Seward actually made possible for Harriet Tubman to have south of town in Auburn, New York. This was what you were referring to before. And so they're there, and so Mark Twain begins by telling a kind of long shaggy dog story, a funny story, and then Frederick Douglass tells one that's equally funny, right? And they're enjoying each other's company immensely, and then they turn to Harriet Tubman and say, would you like to tell a story, and she's saying, I'm fine just sitting here as it is. And then Douglas sort of says, I think it's okay if you want to. And Twain says, I promise not to tell the story to anybody else, you know. And if I do, I'll give you credit, which is kind of a double-edged sword there. And so she goes, all right. So she begins a joke. It's a great joke. I can't tell it to you. You'll have to get Harriet Tubman to tell it to you. It's a famous joke. Anyway, about a pig with a wooden leg. But anyway, and just as she begins the joke, the door opens and Forrest Taylor walks in from where he's been. And all of a sudden, it's like the whole thing freezes. And Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman get up and say, I think we need to be leaving now. Thanks so much for a great evening. And they leave. And then Forrest Taylor is there with Twain. And I should say, Frederick Matthews is sitting there too. He's in on this session.
Drinking.
And, and Taylor starts needling Matthews about why he put Forrest Taylor on the stage, going to be on the stage the next day with Frederick Douglass. And it gets kind of, I don't want to read you, tell you the whole book, but anyway, it's
yeah,
it's the sort of pivot point of the book. And then the next day, things kind of really go off the rails at the second day of the conference.
Yeah, and you really want to hear Harriet Tubman's story. That's a great scene.
So you know, if you Google pig wooden leg joke, you'll find probably about 30 different versions of that joke. So.
That's great. Well, I want to mention one more character. There's this red-haired poet running around, slipping notes to people. And I love those scenes. And I mean, we know who she is, but can you talk about why you brought her to Auburn?
The mysterious red-haired poet. Do I lose anything by saying who it is?
I don't think so, because I think most people are going to get it.
Figure it out.
Do you know who a famous, yeah.
There were a couple of professor types who they made a certain kind. The poet is Emily Dickinson,
yeah.
And she manages to sneak away from home in Amherst and come to this conference because she's an aspiring writer, of course. She's an aspiring poet. And so she goes to
there's major people here.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know,
these are
I can
want to
show them my poems, you know. And so she manages to sneak away while her parents are out of town, and she comes. And so why is she there? I love Emily Dickinson. And she, you know, actually, if there are all these sort of binaries, as I say, in the book, and certainly you could not have two poets whose style was more opposite than Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson. Walt Whitman is just, you know, and Emily Dickinson was all this, you know, such compression. And so I don't, she just seemed to want to be there. Who's, well, I'm going to tell Emily Dickinson, don't come to the conference. Come on, of course. Come on, Emily. So she came, but there are three poems, in the book. And two of which, three Emily Dickinson poems in the book, four line poems. She wrote a lot of these little four line poems. And, two of them were written by Emily Dickinson. And one of them was written by me. And one of the sort of joys of my life so far has been that there was an English professor who had read the book and didn't realize that they weren't all three written by, assumed that the poem that I wrote was written by Emily Dickinson. And it was doubly remarkable because it should have been obvious, because Emily Dickinson is sitting at lunch the first day, and Whitman's across the room bloviating to a couple of young acolytes. And she's sitting there and she writes a poem, a four line poem. And she looks at it and goes, nah, let's take this out and we'll put this down here. And she rewrites the poem. And so that would have been a clue that maybe it wasn't actually Emily Dickinson, but anyway.
Yeah, it's good. It's great. I love that she's there, and we won't reveal much else what happens, but just that sort of atmosphere. I guess just to wrap up too, that writing conferences are sort of a circus of egos, and there's, you know, all sorts of things going on. And I think you really capture that well too, and you know, in an endearing way. It's not pejorative, but it's also really kind of funny because there's all that kind of one-upmanship and the person that goes first speaks and the other people on stage are like, how am I going to follow that? What am I going to do? And so I know that must come from some personal experience of yours, would you say?
No, never.
But it works really, really well. I also just want to mention that there's a moment where Matthews realizes, I mean, things really go to hell, but we're not going to explain. But he realizes at one point that his vision was really more about the books, that like maybe books were going to talk to each other, not complicated human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. Because after all, he lived with the books.
Close to him, yeah.
Right, as he was coming of age, I mean, what all he could have known of these writers was their books, really. And so, and I think, don't we all have that experience to a degree? You read books and I think it's kind of natural that when you encounter somebody who's done work that has made an impression on you, you sort of figure, well, they're probably like that, that's who they are, sort of, you know? But anybody who actually practices an art is aware of that, as I was sort of saying before, that angle. But I lost the thread of the question.
that idea that it's just so much more complicated. I mean, that what's on the page is a work of art. It's been fashioned, like, you know, Emily fixing her poem. And then you have like the actual human beings.
Yeah.
In this situation.
And you were saying that he would, right. So he's Matthews
unprepared.
Was not quite ready
right.
for the degree of complicated human presence that comes with a room full of huge egos. Let's face it. I mean, why would you be a writer, you know, if you didn't have some degree of ego and a take on the world. And if you have a strong take on the world and somebody else enters who has a very different take on the world, it might be a friendly conversation, it might be a kind of antagonistic conversation, but still it creates moiré patterns of meaning and significance. So Matthews, I think, wasn't quite ready for the degree to which there was going to be a combustible dimension in the gathering.
Yeah.
And the book begins, the first panel is Melville and Whitman with their extremely different visions of what American possibility means. And then it ends up really head to head, first with the suffragists and Frederick Douglass, and then with Frederick Douglass and the Confederate memoirist. But it's not just about the Civil War. It's about all the resonance of just what that is and what was attempted and is still being attempted in the aftermath, of this supposed dismantling of slavery. And so these kinds of opposites that are all on every point of the compass, characteristically American and yet totally divergent in their significance, is enough to drive anybody crazy. And as Matthews begins the book, he says, I've come to the conclusion that the entire nation is insane. And in fact, well, and of course, there's the William Carlos Williams remark, the pure products of America go crazy. So, you know, it's very hard for any gathering of sensibilities or, you know, advocacy to not go off the rails.
Yeah.
Maybe I should leave that at that.
Yeah, so we're going to leave that at that. And mm-hmm. I think we have questions in the audience. Yes, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hi.
Were you deliberate about who didn't get invited to the conference? Like, I haven't heard about Hawthorne or Louisa May Alcott, for example.
Mm-hmm. Some deliberate and some not deliberate. Hawthorne, of course, would have actually been a great person to include because of his dark vision, which had such an effect on Melville also, and they were friends. But Hawthorne died before the conference happened. I would have liked to include Emerson for that matter. But Emerson is there almost like as a gray eminence, you know, as a background, I think. And he died before the conference happened. Alcott, you know, to a certain degree, I had to go with writers for whom I felt a degree of affinity. And, I just haven't read the Alcotts. It's, you know, bad on me, but that's just the way it goes, you know. And so, but to that point, one thing that was funny in the composition of the book was that given all the sort of political or social themes of the book, it took me a while to remember that I hadn't thought to include Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Susan B. Anthony or somebody like that. So what happens is the suffragists show up, and Fred, at a rather, the book's well along when they show up and kind of go, hello, what about us? And he's like, oh, well, yes, I tried, but I couldn't. And they say, yeah, you tried. No, you never tried. And we're going to be there. And he's like, thank you so much. We're going to welcome you. And they're like, yeah, right, get lost. Anyway, and then they show up, and they ain't backing up off of anything. But it was funny because it hadn't occurred to me. So then I blamed it on Frederick Matthews. That's a writer for you. Shame on me. But anyway, they come in and they give at least as good as they get. Yeah. Uh-huh. Better. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I love the contrast between the suffragist and Lucy Comstock, who is busy selling her romance novels.
Well, one minute the suffrage, you know, certain members of the suffrage cadre who are there are, you know, she's the typical, Lucy Comstock is just, you know, the typical model of a submissive female who all she wants is to get married. And then the next minute when Lucy Comstock saying, you know, I doubt that all these male writers and all their swashbuckling and everything would be able to last if it weren't for the women who support everything they do and make their lives possible. And then the suffragists are, yeah. So there's really, it's kind of a seesaw for them. But also, you know, it's worth remembering, and it's certainly remembered in the book, that there was a period of a lot of tension between the women's suffrage movement and the movement for voting rights for African Americans.
Yes.
And they get into it actually at one point here because there was a question of who was going to have the franchise first, who was going to be advocated for first. And I won't bother going through the argument now, but it's a central part of the very last part of the book, yeah.
Yeah.
Or a significant part of that.
I love the line from Frederick Douglass that the Constitution is at war with itself.
Mm-hmm.
Is that from perhaps your wife, who's a civil rights lawyer?
Well, since I'm talking to a great civil rights lawyer in response to that, well, you know, Mary, my much better half, and I talk about all these questions, obviously, a lot. But, you know, that actually, I believe, is actually a line that Douglas himself did say. I didn't have to whip it up to put it in his mouth. But he said the Constitution was a document that was at war with itself, obviously, because of its advancement, you know, of these ideals. And yet the obvious way that those ideals are kneecapped repeatedly in the text of the Constitution. So, you know, Douglas is just, what a titanic and really kind of unexplainable figure. I mean, the greatness of what he did in the milieu in which he was operating is just almost inconceivable, you know. But that idea of the document at war with itself, because at the end, the narrator, the organizer is asking people to define what they mean by an American. And everybody offers some version of their idea of what they mean by an American. And finally, Matthews, after the conference, kind of goes, maybe it just amounts to a person at war with themselves between competing senses of what's right and what is achievable. I don't know if that's a great answer, but.
There are two moments in the book when I did a double take because I thought, am I seeing a reference to a Joni Mitchell lyric here? So it's either a product of my overheated imagination or I'm right. And if so, are there only two or did I catch them all?
Will you tell me what they were?
Yeah. There's one moment where Emily Dickinson is talking about wishing that she had a river to skate away on.
Yes, ma'am.
Which was the first one that sensitized me to it, because that's a pretty, you know,
well,
that's a pretty in-your-face
one. There's a real resonance between Emily Dickinson and Joni Mitchell. Good
I mean, I Googled it to see, did Joni take that from Dickinson?
No, okay. No.
The second one was...
Emily Dickinson stole it from Joni Mitchell. Indefensible, but...
With a time machine. The second one is on the midway, the man with the ruby in his ear.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really? Really? Am I right?
Yeah. It's from that song about the midway.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Are there any more? Should I read it again just with an eye to that?
I think you should read it again.
Well, I'm going to.
Maybe it's
everyone
there. Maybe
should
it
read
isn't.
It again.
Did I catch them all, though?
I think so. Nice. My memory is imperfect.
Nice.
That's pretty great. I thank you for that.
Totally.
That was thrilling, actually, that you did that.
Well, I love that you mentioned music. That was going to be one of my questions. This is a really musical, written by ear. I mean, you really hear it. I love that you said that earlier. It's just saturated. So. Beautifully done.
Just to close us out, I wanted to ask both of you if you would tell us who would be at your personal Auburn conference.
Oh my God, I was going to ask. That was one of my other questions. If you could have another conference.
Who would you invite?
So do they have to be alive or can they be? Yeah. Like I could say James Baldwin.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yes. Oh God, there's so many. I guess I would bring Faulkner in. Dr. William Faulkner, bring back Joan Didion. I think we need a little more of her. So many poets. I don't know.
Yeah.
What did you have?
It's a really tough question.
It's a tough question.
Yeah. I got asked that in just about every interview I've done for this book, for the Library of America. Elvis Costello did one with me for Katie Couric's website. It always comes up. Who would you invite?
Would you have? Yeah.
And I always found it a kind of quasi, you know, living people they wanted to. Guil Marcus in his Substack postings proffered his notion of who he would invite. I was able to make it as far as the post-World War II writers. I've Baldwin, the writers who were engaged with the fate of the nation, you know, but who were also great stylists, Baldwin, Norman Mailer, Joan Didion, you know, James Baldwin, all of these, there was a whole sort of drop menu of them. But then I also thought, really, if I was going to, it sounds like a flippant answer, but I would say, you know, Bob Dylan is kind of a one-man Auburn conference. I mean, if you think of all the different Bob Dylan's he has been, and all the different angles that he's approached American life and the inner life from, I always sort of thought, well, yeah, you kind of get it all in one package there in a funny way.
And Bob Dylan conference.
Yeah. Well, and now there is a Bob Dylan Center out in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and if you go there, you'll have a party for sure.
I just want to say thank you to both of you for being here and for this wonderful conversation. Please help me in thanking our guests one more time and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.